You are listening to a sermon by Evan Kreider, recorded on Sunday, July 29th, 2012, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Please turn to 2 Samuel chapter 11, starting at verse 1. It's a well-known story. I'm going to say just a few things about the story, pointing out a few things in the verses, and then I'll make observations. 2 Samuel 11:1. Although the king is traditionally supposed to lead his troops, David stays at home. We don't know why. During this particular war season, I'm troubled that there's a season for war. It's spring, therefore it's time to fight. And this was very much part of the Middle Ages thinking. Possibly David stayed home because his strategic decisions were not required during a protracted siege or digging of trenches. The city is later going to be named Philadelphia, and it's going to be a major city later on. We do know that most of the booty from war would go to the king and pay for his army, his palaces, sort of boost the federal budget a little bit. In verse 2, it happened. In English, we sometimes say, things happen. Bathsheba was cleansing herself after her period, according to the Jewish rite of purification. And the point is, she was not pregnant by Uriah. Many people wonder what a woman is doing bathing where she can be seen on the roof from the palace. Some even wonder what constitutes bathing, sounding like Clinton. But was this behind a lattice? Was it in a tent? This does not seem to be a problem for the author of this story. And so even though it puzzles me, I'm not going to go there. Verse 3, David makes an enormous mistake, and this sets wheels of the story in motion. David saw something he should not have seen. But instead of dropping the matter, he pursues it. Now David already had multiple wives, various concubines, so presumably sex would have been available to him that evening from a variety of sources. Possibly David having a harem had become part of his problem. Perhaps he had come to view women as things to be added to his kingly collection, something that the reading from Deuteronomy said was not to happen. There's also existed the possibility of I could go to a man and say, would you divorce your wife so that I can marry her? That's another possibility for the king, but that did not happen. Whatever, David was playing with fire, morally and politically. Not only was Bathsheba the wife of a trusted warrior, and one of the warriors who sometimes guarded David's life. But if the ancestry in one of the accounts is correct, she was the granddaughter of one of King David's closest advisors. So in a very real sense, this bathing beauty was not simply another pretty face. And later she's going to be portrayed as the master of palace intrigue. In verse 4, most agree that at this point in the story, Bathsheba had no choice as a woman but to obey the powerful king and go to the palace. Some scholars even suggest the text should read, David sent messengers to take her. If so, she had absolutely no choice. I think the writer wants us to conclude that she was raped by David and then sent home. And the speed and ease with which this happened suggests to me that this may not have been David's first one-night stand. Verse 11, and I'm skipping a lot of the story. By this time, David tries to get Uriah to have sex with his wife, and Uriah refuses. The phrase, "go home and wash your feet," not used much today, and it does not refer to foot washing, ladies and gentlemen. It's another way of saying go and sleep with your wife. Uriah refused. And the reason given followed the ancient thinking and Jewish practice according to Deuteronomy. If you are a soldier in the field, you do not have the comforts of home, of sex, and you do not even masturbate. You keep your strength for the duty at hand. When you said the word of the Lord, none of us responded. It's a hard story. It's a hard story. Verse 12. One writer pointed out there's nothing in this story to suggest that Uriah was a particularly loving husband, and I don't know if that's fair or not. I just honestly don't know. Verse 13, David tried to get Uriah drunk so that he would go home and have sex, but Uriah still did not sleep with his wife. Clearly, no one could have gotten into the palace. Bathsheba and the messenger, or whatever, could not have gotten into David's palace that night unseen. The palace is guarded. There are assassins about. They know who's going into the palace. Guards knew what went on. And we are not told in the story that Uriah knew, but I wonder, would his buddies have told him? By verse 14 in the story, we know already that she has conceived. She sent a letter to the pregnant. It was a very short letter, "I am pregnant," to the king. And they knew Uriah could do the math. Now, a supposedly secret one-night stand had to be covered up. It had to be silenced, according to David's thinking. And one wrong is going to lead to another. So, some reflections on this story. The writer of Chronicles is far more kind to David than the writer of 2 Samuel. The writer of Chronicles simply says, David married Bathsheba. The writer of 2 Samuel tells us in great detail what went on, and he seems to be writing with inside knowledge and writing dispassionately. He is not trying to put a good spin on things, and that's very refreshing. Ultimately, we think David had 8 wives. At least 10 concubines are known. The concubines were essentially wives drawn from a lower social class, but they were still legit. One wonders, did David know of the passage in Deuteronomy that Peter read for us? Your king must not acquire many horses. He must not acquire many wives for himself. And also silver and gold he must not acquire in great quantity for himself. And the king was supposed to keep this law written down. He was supposed to read it all the days of his life, never exalting himself above other members of the community. This story in the book of 2 Samuel marks a turning point in David's reign. From this point on, events overtake David. He is no longer shown as being in control of events. His abuse of power, his abuse of military as military commander, his abuse as king, his abuse as a male, and his horrific parenting skills led to other serious errors, which are going to be enumerated in the rest of 2 Samuel. As for Bathsheba, later we read that she conspired with Nathan the prophet to have Solomon be named as David's successor as king. She had to do that or she would die. It was already the pattern that if you became king of Israel, as soon as you had enough power, you killed all of your rivals. Solomon does not kill his half-brother until he has enough power to do so. And then, we think with his mother Bathsheba, they trump up a charge, and without a trial, he is killed. Bathsheba, therefore, eventually becomes the queen mother via Solomon, and is the first queen mother in Israel, a very powerful position. Bathsheba is thought by some to have written part of Proverbs 31, verse 10 and following. Or Jewish tradition says possibly she quoted it at her wedding to David. In Matthew's genealogy, Bathsheba is listed as an ancestor of Jesus, but she is not listed by name. She is only called the wife of Uriah. Later in the second book of Samuel, David's troubles begin in earnest. In 2 Samuel 13, David's daughter Tamar was raped by David's eldest son Amnon. Amnon was presumably the next in line for the throne. Unlike the story of Bathsheba in the same book, Tamar's protestations are recorded in amazing detail. She objects as strongly as possible on religious and moral grounds, but is nevertheless raped by her half-brother. Her full brother, Absalom, then looks after her, but the whole episode destroys her soul. David hears of the abomination of incest and rape and does nothing. He refuses to act. 2 years later, Absalom plots against and kills Amnon by a ruse, much like his father David had killed Uriah by a ruse. David heard what had happened, felt powerless, and did nothing. Even though David was head of the family and presumably the chief enforcer of laws in the land, he did nothing. Absalom flees, leads a revolt against David, crowns himself as king. David flees Jerusalem, and in chapter 16, this dysfunctional family comes to full flowering. Absalom sleeps openly with his father's 10 concubines. This is seen as a tenfold retribution for David sleeping with the wife of another man. By the example of his life, David taught his sons to rape, use deception, grasp power by force, and kill. Like father, like son. We have heard the saying, the sins of the fathers will be visited on the children. And we know that children often imitate what their parents do, not just what they say. And sometimes we have seen entire families suffer if even one of the parents lives a life of perpetual sin. Jesus said in Luke 12, "There is nothing covered up that will not be revealed. There is nothing hidden that will not be known. Accordingly, whatever you have said in the dark shall be heard in the light, and what you have whispered in the inner rooms shall be proclaimed upon the housetops." Ted Haggard found this to be true, as did John Edwards and quite a few Kennedys and other presidents and the president of the IMF and our fellowship's last pastor. David certainly found this to be true. I have often assumed a number of things about this specific story. I have assumed that David sinned secretly because he thought he could get away with it. I have assumed that he carefully orchestrated Uriah's murder in order to have a political, personal cover-up. I've assumed he was discovered and the infant son died as a result of the sin. And some commentators say it was probably a mercy the son died, to be viewed as an illegitimate son within the palace would have been hell. I've assumed that David confessed, possibly composing Psalm 51, and ta-da, I have assumed that all was forgiven, and that David was henceforth a good boy. But in preparation for this, I sadly read all of 1 and 2 Samuel, all of 1 and 2 Kings, and I gave up in Chronicles. I am now against the monarchy. It is not good. And David's actions suggest to me that when he confessed, he may not have really understood everything that needed to be confessed. Because actions continue. What is the role of understanding what needs to be confessed and confessing it? And this is something that our generation has been grappling with, particularly with sex scandals within the church. David, that powerful king, repeatedly refused to discipline himself, with bad consequences. He refused to discipline his sons, either for rape or for murder, even when the heir apparent was murdered. And later on, even when David was sexually impotent, he continued to use women as things. He slept with still more virgins in bed. We are told to keep warm. Impotency, sexual impotency was seen as a sign that maybe it's time for a new king. If he can't lead in bed, how can he lead in battle? And so it's possible that having the young virgin sleep with him, there was hope that potency would be revived and he could continue his leadership. Whatever. He is still using his power over women at the end of his life, as before, even if he is only using them as hot water bottles. After such an abhorrent story, in which a truly gifted military general, a poet, a gifted musician, wastes his life and abuses his power, whatever can we take home with us? Well, if you're going to shower on the roof, pull the curtain. But I think all I can offer is the golden rule. I'm not going to give it the way Jesus did. I'm going to give it the way the Jews did the golden rule. Do not do unto others things that you do not want them to do to you. If that simple rule had been followed, 2 Samuel would have been a very different book. Israel would have been a very different nation. If we can follow it, our lives will be good.